U.S. factory activity slowed.
Based on hitting a shareholder value as market capitalization.
A lot more global. So creating more programming not only for, you know, us here in the English-speaking U.S.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Welcome to Friday afternoon. Let's call it the weekend here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand in the Skyline Studio, high atop the Chicago River on Wacker Drive, Chicago, Illinois. Thanks very much for tuning in today and every day that you do. Appreciate that. A little bit later in the program, we will talk to a reporter at Claire Bushey from Cranes. You know, you just heard Orion talk about the idea that there was perhaps they're getting closer to a Chinese trade deal. Claire is writing in Cranes today at chicagobusiness.com about how Illinois farmers have been impacted by that. So we will talk to her coming up a little bit later. Also in the second half hour, I fell for this. The advertising works even when you work in radio. My wife and I are going to go up to Isnala tomorrow for dinner, and it's only because of the commercial. It just sounds so cool that I want to go up and check it out for myself. I went to school in Wisconsin and kind of like that. So we'll talk to Bob Prosser. He's the brains behind Isnala, and maybe we'll get a lesson in the history of the old-fashioned as well. But we start on Fridays generally with Andrea Haines from the Chicago Tribune. She's on the phone line now. Andrea, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Okay, when's the last time you had an old-fashioned?
Probably kind of never. That's not my drink. You know, some of my friends really like it. It seems like it's, I don't know, maybe it never went away, but it seems like it's having a resurgence.
I don't know that I've ever had an old-fashioned, but I hear you can make one with bourbon, an old-fashioned sour or something. I don't know, but it's a supper club drink, and I guess much more widely used in Wisconsin than elsewhere, so we'll kick that around a little bit later. But while we're talking about food and drink and all of that, Kellogg is finally getting into the business of a fake meat burger, right?
They are. So Kellogg's, which does Morningstar Farms, which I think has been popular with vegetarians and others for years, they do a breakfast sausage that's been very popular.
I think I have their chicken sandwiches. Yeah, I have their chicken sandwiches sometimes.
Yep. They have the vegetarian chickens. So they're now sort of upgrading their offerings to get into this world of the plant-based imitation meat that really looks like beef.
And it's described as a soy burger that bleeds, which... well, it's got me lined up to buy it already.
I know, right? It's like, it depends on how your viewpoint, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
What does it mean?
If you want that true grilled, you know, that look and feel of a burger that you're looking for, the quote-unquote bleeding, you know, I guess is a plus.
And Kellogg is an interesting story because they've kind of owned the meatless burger or the fake meat sort of corner of the market. And then they still lead it, but they've been losing their market share, right? They've kind of been falling behind the Impossible Burger and places like that.
Exactly. They've been the number one seller of what we used to call the veggie burger.
The veggie burger.
Yeah, that was maybe the common name for it. But that was, you know, generally made out of like black beans or mushrooms or truly a veggie based, you know, based on actual vegetables. And now these sort of plant-based concoctions are obviously more popular. So Kellogg is now doing a little bit of ketchup to try to get a bigger piece of that market back.
You didn't just say ketchup, did you?
Oh, my gosh, the puns.
So when we say plant-based burger, I suppose they're each different, but are we basically talking soy burger? I mean, that's what they're talking about here.
Yeah, often it can be that. It's all just, it's plant-based, but not necessarily a recognizable veggie in the way that a veggie burger used to be.
And they're going to put this in the meat aisle, which I would imagine will anger some farmers?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's a lot still to shake out here because these, you know, will be placed in the meat case. I think you will get, you know, there's always pushback on what can you call cheese? What can you truly call milk? And I'm sure what you can call meat, you know, will be fought out too.
So, and I should know this because really we talk about this part of the industry a lot on this show, but can you buy Impossible Foods or Beyond Meat? Can you buy those burgers at the grocery store now?
You can.
Oh, you can. Okay.
Beyond, I think, was quicker into the grocery stores than Impossible. Impossible now, we've talked about, is in Burger King.
We've talked about it in restaurants, but I didn't realize that you could go and buy it and grill it yourself and see it bleed on the grill for yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's that. Jen DeSalvo in the newsroom had a story in the news about, and this was out yesterday too, Walgreens adding its name to the list of people saying that if you live in an open carry state where it's legal to hip a gun to your holster, they're asking you not to walk into their stores.
Yes, these retailers that operate nationally, which includes Walgreens, although they are based here, they have stores in all 50 states. And, you know, the laws vary about whether you can carry a gun, whether you can conceal carry. I think many of us have seen pictures in the news or on social media of people coming into Walmart, which has been the location of several shootings lately, with huge weapons on their body. And people are debating, do you feel safe and comfortable if you're in a store and some random person is carrying a huge weapon? So the retailers are trying to jump in, and they're basically discouraging, not necessarily banning, but discouraging customers from openly carrying guns, and those include Walmart as well as Kroger, Starbucks, and Target, and now Walgreens as well.
It is such a weird, I mean, I don't want to get into the whole gun debate, but it's just so foreign to me that there are places, well, I mean, they're everywhere now, but where you can strap a gun to your hip and walk around in public. It's so weird for me to imagine that, but I know big parts of this country you can do it.
It is. It really points out how, again, when you operate nationally, you have areas of the country where the thought process is just so different. I mean, hunting is a deep part of the culture in many places.
Yeah, but it's not hunting.
People are much more comfortable with guns.
But if you have a holster and a pistol on your hip, that's not hunting. That's like you are walking around like you are in such fear that you think you might need to use it.
Yeah, and I think that is bringing it out, these shootings. You know, there are areas where people are more comfortable handling guns on a daily basis, and they are wearing them, I guess, thinking that they may discourage the bad guy from doing something, but I think it's questionable. Well, and it certainly confuses the issue for law enforcement because they can't tell at a glance who's a good guy or who's a bad guy.
And like I said, I ended up getting into the gun issue. I didn't mean to, but there's that. So for these stores, and I think one of the things they want to keep their other patrons from being scared into thinking there's a mass shooter because someone's in there legally with a gun. They're asking their customers not to do this, but by law, their customers can do it, and they can't really ban them, right?
Yeah, in some states, you know, the law protects the right to be doing that, I guess. But part of it is also that they don't want to put their own employees on the front lines of having to confront somebody with a gun.
Right.
Like, if they actually ban it, how are they going to enforce that? Is some person making probably minimum wage going to now be expected to go up to somebody with a gun and hassle them about it? Like, that really puts their own employees into a difficult spot.
And so think of that. So you would like to ban the guns, but you really can't because you're afraid of the people who are following the law and bringing guns in the store.
It's twisted.
It's upside down. Okay, one other thing. So, and this is a great development, I think. The automobile industry has agreed to make, by 2025, audible advisories for people getting out of the car to check the back seat for their kids. I think there have been 35 kids who've died so far this year in hot back seats, and the auto industry seems to be doing something about that.
Yes, and this issue drives me absolutely bananas because you and I talk every week about all these super, you know, tech developments, like everything is so technologically savvy, they know everything we're doing. My car, which is not a new car, is 10 years old. It screams at me if I leave the keys in while I pump the gas. You know, the car knows everything that you're doing, but we have not solved this problem of kids accidentally being left in cars. I would add to that, in some cases, pets that are left in there for too long. Figure out a way to alert and alarm people so that these situations, when they're accidental, don't have to happen.
So this would be just a reminder when you're getting out of the car, hey, look in the back seat kind of thing, right?
Yes. Right. And, you know, Congress is actually considering a bill that would require alerts like that. This is still not happening until the 2025 year that all the U.S. automakers will be doing it, but it is starting to show up in certain models already.
All right, Andrea Haines, read more about this at thechicagotribune.com. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too, Steve.
It's 12:23. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Okay, just before the show started, they put up on the WGN website the first of our Steve Bertrand travel trips for next year. I've been dropping hints about it earlier this spring or summer, I should say, but it's now official. We're going to go to Madrid, Bordeaux, San Sebastian in Spain, and then up to Paris. And the details are up at WGNradio.com or at SteveBertrandTravel.com. I already released it to my email list. I'll give you more details on it later in the program, but just wanted to let you know it was up. Okay, so the big thing now in Chicago when it comes to eating are food halls. I think there have been 9 announced since 2016, a couple more coming from a company called Urban Space from, I think they started in London. They've got some success in New York. The CEO is on the phone line now, Eldon Scott. Eldon, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So we started with this in London, right, in the 70s?
Yeah, Eric Reynolds started the company in the 70s with Camden Lock and Spitalfields Market, and it was, you know, different world back then, but some of the principles stay the same.
Well, is the food market idea, because I think of the French market over by the Ogilvy train station. I mean, is this kind of a European idea that's made its way over here?
I mean, food markets have been around since the beginning of time, so it's just markets coming, it's local merchants coming back in different iterations.
Okay,
you see that with different generations.
Well, I mean, but I think of the food court at the mall or something like that, but food markets are very different from that, and I know yours will be here. You've got one on Washington, I think the old Woolworths building, and the other coming in the revamped Willis Tower. How do you pick the restaurants that go into those spots?
We're really looking for great local entrepreneurs. And, you know, generally, we don't want someone who's got more than a few restaurants. Ideally, they have a restaurant, so they have some of that culinary experience. But, you know, there's been a sea change in how we eat, and I think people are looking for really great local chefs that have quality, and that's kind of why this is different than a food court, for example.
And so the one on Washington, that's going to open first, right? When's that slated to open?
End of the year.
End of the year, okay. And Willis Tower will come, what, sometime next year then?
Yeah, the middle of next year.
And so do you know the lineup, the restaurant lineup for the downtown one?
We're bringing in Roberta's from Brooklyn, who's someone we work with quite a bit. So we have two or three that we're bringing in from other cities, and then the rest will be local. We also have Black Iron Burger, which is a very cool concept, a guy from Seville who started a burger joint in the Lower East Side here. But we also have like the Bud Long, which is a mainstay already in Chicago.
Right.
So it's going to be an interesting mix.
Bud Long, they do the hot chicken. I think it's great.
Yeah. Okay. Really, really great product.
So let me ask you this, Eldon, when it comes to choosing restaurants, does it vary by, obviously it would vary by city to city, but does it vary by neighborhood to neighborhood as well? I mean, is there a particular food that might work well at the Washington location that may, for one reason or not work so well when you open up the Willis location?
There are differences. It's kind of crazy. There are certain standbys that people are always looking for, you know, like, you know, pizza and chicken sandwich, but there's lots of Asian, but there's always differences by location, and you try your best in advance to figure that out, but the places take a life of their own as they develop, so it's almost hard to anticipate. But that's the great thing about a market environment, is that it's got change built into it, so we can be responsive to what the consumer wants in that neighborhood.
So how does that work if you start in the market? If you're one of the 20 at the beginning, you sign a year or two lease, or you're only guaranteed so long, and then you might be moved out?
You really only move people along if the sales aren't there. So
right.
It's the ultimate market. You know, the consumers vote with their feet.
I guess, right. It'd be in their interest to move out as well. You announced a contest this week, right, for a food entrepreneur in Chicago to get a chance at this Washington market. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's something that we've been doing before, and it starts October 1st, so we're just getting in. The decision will be made by October 1st. And the idea is for local entrepreneurs and chefs who've got a great idea to be able to reach out, and the winner will get a space in one of the food halls. And it's been really successful when we've done it in other cities. And you'd just be amazed at the quality of the ideas and the concepts that we get in.
Yeah, urban. It's at urbanspacechallenge.com, and I think the applications are open now, and they're open through October 1st. And then if you're chosen, you don't just get space, but you guys will help. Urban Space will help as well with marketing, menuing, and all of that stuff too.
Yeah. I mean, we've just been doing this so long that we found that what could we do to give back to the communities we're going into, and that is really helping local entrepreneurs. And even when we're not helping them, the other chefs are helping each other. So when they're in the same environment, it's kind of like an incubator.
I was just going to say, it's like a real-life, moment-to-moment incubator.
Yeah, it does work that way. And as you know, it's really tough for restaurateurs these days with labor costs and rent and legal fees. So what this does is it's a great model that enables them to share costs with the overall food hall. They can focus just on what they do best, which is whatever their menu and their food is.
Eldon,
and we can help them with a lot of the other stuff.
Eldon Scott's the CEO of Urban Space. All right, you've got us hungry. Can't wait for the spots to open.
Thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Jen DeSalvo. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, it's a Friday afternoon, essentially the weekend, so why don't we talk about what you're doing for dinner this week? So I was talking to some friends about the brandy old fashioned, right? And looked into a little history of it. The old fashioned actually came out of the 1893 World's Fair here in Chicago, and then got its popularity, gained in popularity anyway, during Prohibition. I am not an expert on the brandy old-fashioned, but I think Bob Prosser, the man behind the Ishnala Supper Club, is, and he joins us on a phone line now. Bob, welcome to the Business
Lunch.
Hey,
how are you, Steve?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing terrific.
All right, so tell me about the old... I read an article that said that 40% of the people who take a dinner at your supper club order an old-fashioned of one form or another. Is that true?
That is correct, and most of them, probably 85%, do brandy. And we have a local winery, Woolersheim Winery in Sauk City, right down the road from us, and they have a brandy that we feature on our brandy old-fashioned. And then the rest of them, and it's brandy old-fashioned sweet, is majority of the people. And then there's a lot of bourbon people these days, and they're starting to switch over to like Maker's Mark or something like that,
right.
A bourbon old-fashioned sour, which is an excellent old-fashioned.
And so,
and the history from the Prohibition is because they were making such rot-gut booze years ago that they had to flavor it up so they could drink it. I mean, that's basically the bottom line, was they put sugar in it and bitters and stirred it up, and it took hold in the supper club world up here in Wisconsin.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. So, right, it basically was a disguise that grew out of Prohibition, but it stayed in Wisconsin, right? It's still popular there, but not so popular around the rest of the country. Why do you suppose that is?
You know, that's a mystery. I mean, it's probably because we sell more brandy in Wisconsin than any other state. I mean, we I don't know what the numbers is, but it's staggering. And it's just, we have all the supper clubs. I think there's 260 or 270 last count in Wisconsin. And it just grew from that. Those were a lot of them were old dance halls that converted over to the supper clubs once Prohibition ended. So they grabbed that brandy and mixed it up, and now it's just become it's a tradition thing. You know, when you come into our place, you can look at the bars, and all lined up all the way around the bar are the old fashioned, and we have a special old fashioned glass. You know, it tastes better when it says Ishnala old fashioned.
Sure, it does, Bob. I'm sure. So it seems to me now you've been around since 1953. The hundreds of others I'm sure have been around a long time. But has there been a resurgence in supper clubs in Wisconsin, or has it sort of been sort of a steady popularity?
A big resurgence.
Okay.
In 2016, the state of Wisconsin, the Tourism Bureau of Wisconsin decided to feature supper clubs, which was great for us in the industry. So their whole year campaign was basically promoting supper clubs throughout Wisconsin. We were fortunate enough that they also did a contest on voting for your best supper club, and there were about 400,000 votes cast for the whole month of September in 2016. And we were fortunate enough to end up with about 40% of the vote. We smoked everybody and had it. And so we can market everywhere that we're the number one supper club in Wisconsin.
All right, so
it was thanks to the Tourism Bureau initially promoting us, and then Ron Fiola wrote a book, did a documentary.
Right.
Then he wrote a book, and we were on the cover of that. So we've had some good fortune with some of the marketing people that felt that we deserved to be number one.
Okay, listen, so this came first. Your radio ad on WGN, I think, is so good. I'm not kidding you, Bob. You lured me up there. My wife and I are going to go up for dinner tomorrow night just because I want to check it out. And after we talked about it, we said, well, let's have him on to talk about it. But it's not related to anything other than that. I heard the commercial, and it's so intriguing. I want to check it out. So what percentage of your customers are local to the Mirror Lake area, and what percentage travel just for dinner?
I would guess that we're probably 65% is from out of town.
Wow.
And the rest is local. We get a lot of people that come up here. Specifically, what you're doing tomorrow night is they drive 3 hours, they drive 4 hours, they drive 2 hours. Chicago, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, we're hearing it every night from people saying, hey, we drove here 3 hours just to come here, and then they stay at a local hotel and have nice dinner with us, and it's a whole evening because you have to plan on being here a while to get the whole experience. We have three bars, two decks, and it's usually, I call it a 2 to 3 old-fashioned wait.
Well,
and so instead of telling you how much time, you know, it's about 3 old-fashioned. Well, enjoy yourself and just look over Mirror Lake.
So you don't take reservations, and you tell people that they're going to wait to, and you know, wait to eat, and people are okay with that. I mean, that's just part of it.
That's part of it. People come here expecting to go through the whole experience. Instead of being in a hurry, going to, you know, somewhere fast, we're going to come here, take your time, have a cocktail at the bar or two, and meet other people that are like-minded to come here and just enjoy themselves. We have a beautiful deck overlooking Mirror Lake, and it looks like a mirror. I mean, you can see the reflection, and it's just so cool and peaceful. You feel like you're in a different area. You're in northern Wisconsin, you know, you feel like you're way up north. You take a mile drive into our property through the woods, basically, and all of a sudden, boom, there's this big parking lot with the supper club overlooking the lake, and we're right butted up close to the water.
I guess if 65% of your diners are coming from out of town, it explains it, but you're also seasonal, and you do so well during the season that you can afford to shut down over the winter, or is it just that you wouldn't have the clients during the winter?
No, I think we would have the clients during the winter. There's just several reasons. When people say to me, why aren't you open year-round? The first thing I say is because I don't want to, because I have to be here. I'm here 6-7 nights a week during the season. I love it, but I've been doing this for 40 years, and I don't want to do it year-round, number one. Number two, I think it would take away from we need to get there because they're only open for a limited time. I think it takes away from the specialness.
So you're the McRib of the supper club world.
Something like that, yes. or a lobster tail or the filet or something like that.
Okay, so what's the signature? What should people order up there?
I would order the dinner for two, which is a 24-ounce ribeye. That's aged at least 40 plus days, so it's tender, it's flavorful. And then two lobster tails, 5 to 6 ounce cold water lobster tails for you to share. So you got a 24 ounce ribeye, two lobster tails, asparagus spears, the wedge salad, and cap it off and make sure you have a Ishnala Reserve. We have our own wine that Willersheim made for us. It's a red blend of Cabernet and Syrah. So you have a nice bottle of wine with that dinner for two, and the dessert's going to be your classic grasshopper or our own toasted caramel canoe, which is toasted almond whiskey, rum chata, and sea salt, or brandy old-fashioned cheesecake.
Well, I don't know, Bob, because you said the wait is a 2 or 3 old-fashioned, and then everything you've discussed since has been another drink. We could be in trouble.
Well, yeah, Uber it, will you?
Bob Prosser is
pace yourself.
I'm going to walk from 94. Bob is the man behind Ishnala Supper Club. Congrats, and maybe I'll see you tomorrow night. We'll see.
Oh, yeah, I hope to see you. I look forward to it. And thanks so much for everything WGN does and you. We appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you as well. It's the Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
start the timer because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Hey, all you coffee fiends out there, I have such good news for you. You know the old Crate and Barrel that was on Michigan Avenue for years? Yeah. And you know how the world's largest Starbucks Reserve Roastery is set to take its place? Yeah. Well, November 25th at 10 a.m. will be the official grand opening.
Yes! I love coffee!
The 43,000 square foot Starbucks will be the sixth in the world, with others in Milan, New York, Seattle, Shanghai, and Tokyo. And if you've never had freshly roasted coffee, then this is probably the place to have it.
It's good. Did I mention I like coffee? How many cups is okay? I've had 12. I can hear my heart.
Can you hear my heart?
Should I be concerned you can hear my heart?
Whoa, 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 whoa. Calm down. And two Chicago-based food industry giants are teaming up and bringing some of the most popular food to consumers through one of the most iconic food delivery services. McDonald's and Grubhub are now together. But the kicker is that they'll begin this offering only to New Yorkers. Sorry, Chicago. Guess we'll have to wait. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
It's 12:54 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, if you go to chicagobusiness.com today, you'll see an article by Claire Bushy about grain farmers, the soybean farmers in Illinois, and their impact, the impact that the Chinese trade war is having on them. She joins us now from the newsroom at Crane Chicago Business. Claire, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, it struck me reading the story that the first thing that came up wasn't what's going on in China today, but it's what happened with the Soviet Union 40 years ago in the around 1980.
Yes, what's happening with the trade war today put some farmers in mind when Jimmy Carter slapped an embargo on selling grain to the Soviet Union in 1980. And what ended up happening is the Soviet Union increased its own internal domestic wheat production, eventually becoming an exporter to the world market, which has created a situation where 40 years later, they're still undercutting U.S. prices.
And speaking of 40 years later, as I recall, that embargo was sparked by the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and Afghanistan has been at war ever since. That's a different story, I guess. But so the grain for the soy farmers in Illinois are different today because of the boycott 40 years ago, you're saying?
Well, it's a comparable situation, some people feel.
Okay.
And the idea that you can do a lot of damage to the agricultural industry in a short period of time, and you can't necessarily fix it just when you undo the embargo or lift tariffs.
So how are they feeling now, the farmers? I mean, are they feeling strong economic impact today because of the trade war?
Yes. Illinois is the number one producer of soybeans in the country. So when we talk about U.S. exports of soybeans to China, a lot of those are going to be beans grown in Illinois. And the U.S. market share in China has been dropping. It was at 39% a couple years ago. It was down to 30%, and we're really going to see the brunt of it when we get the next year's statistics. There's been a huge drop,
right,
to our number one customer.
And so they're buying, I think, from South America, and in a weird twist, because the Soviets upped their own production back in 1980, Russia now is able to fill the gap left by the U.S. farmers?
Well, actually what's happening is China started buying its soybeans from South America, specifically from Brazil. And we are now less able to compete with Brazil because infrastructure has been built up in that country in order to supply the beans more cheaply to China.
Right.
And it's not like that infrastructure, the roads and the rails that make it cheaper to get the beans from Brazil to China, that's not going to go away when the trade war ends. So Illinois will have lost an important competitive advantage against one of their main rivals in this world market.
Claire Bushy writes about the Illinois impact of the Chinese trade war. Claire, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it. I enjoyed the article.
Thank you very much. It's